welcome to Showing Up with Good Culture.
I'm Liz McCouche.
And I'm Jordan Mitchell.
So Showing Up is a podcast with purpose where we speak to the change makers who are positively contributing to culture in their own way to impact the world around them.
In this all new series, we want to speak to the people who have used their platforms to ultimately do good and show up for those who need it most, our very own gatekeepers in culture.
In today's episode, we are delighted to be speaking to one of the UK's leading marketeers, Nishma Robb, a champion for representation and inclusivity in her industry.
Nishma is the Senior Brand and Reputation Marketing Director at Google and is the epitome of a positive gatekeeper. She is a champion for female leadership and racial diversity. Nishma has been instrumental in addressing how marketing and technology has a critical role to play in addressing social inequalities. She has led several of Google's acclaimed projects and campaigns around Skills to Go with Ian Wright MBE, Stephen Bartlett, The More We Learn with Marcus Rashford MBE, Google's partnership with Black Pound Day, and many more.
Nishma is dedicated to giving her time to mentor next-gen talent. Last year, she featured in Campaign Magazine's Power List. She's a founding member of Media for All and will become the president of WACL, which is Women in Advertising and Communications Leadership, in 2023. However, Nishma says her greatest achievement is being mother to her amazing 14-year-old twins and to Millie the Multi-Poo and learning to DJ. We can't wait to find out more about that.
So Nishma, thank you so much for joining us today. We are so excited to be speaking to you. Our first question is always, what does showing up mean to you?
Oh, well, thank you first so much for that wonderful intro. I'm incredibly embarrassed about, but I can also say I'm equally fangirling back to the two of you who are incredible women in our industry and doing just amazing things in culture. I love the fact that I often bump into you at places and you're always doing something fabulous. And yes, congratulations, Liz. I have followed with admiration your love and your life and everything you're doing. So congrats to you and Al.
We've got a lot in common. So you married a Scot and you've got twins. So we're practically sisters.
Exactly. We can swap notes.
We can.
So thank you for the question. Thank you for the opportunity to have this conversation. I always feel very humbled and embarrassed by that intro, but it is definitely true to my passion and something I love and invest a lot of time in is thinking about the change that we can all make and being responsible with the platforms we have. I think to your question around, you know, what do I think, you know, kind of turning up and showing up and doing that, I think one of the things that... I'll be very honest about it, was I think I was quite late or maybe it was just perfect timing in terms of my kind of life and career to really lean into that purpose and recognize that actually I could have an impact and that we can all and purpose is sometimes such an overused term. And I often, when I'm mentoring a lot of young women and men as well, that the pressure to find your passion and your purpose and do good is sometimes can be overwhelming, but actually there's a reality of life that leads you there. But for me, showing up and having that impact is kind of critical to really what I suppose drives our soul. And for me, it's more than the talking, it's the doing. I have been part of too many environments, meetings, forums, where there was a conversation and there's little action at the end of it. And I actually make a rule of it myself. Actually, it was a great piece of advice that the wonderful Miriam Gonzalez gave me many years ago. So Miriam is an incredible European lawyer. She is also the founder of Inspiring Girls. And I remember speaking with her many years ago, actually having done some mentoring at school with her. And she said to me, only invest your time in the things where you know you can have an impact, because it's so easy to get distracted by ways that you think you're doing good and not actually seeing the end result of it. And I think sometimes showing up can be in sometimes the smallest of ways. It's not always the biggest of actions. Sometimes it's not always thinking about being the star on the stage. Actually, I think a lot of the time I think about creating the stage, finding a platform and actually handing it over to somebody else. It's very true to the work I do at Google and Google as a business, but also to myself. It's really what I believe in is creating space and opportunity for others. I'm so excited about Next Generation. I always say to people, when I have down days, when you're kind of immersed in some of the more challenging aspects of life, and the reason why I do a lot of mentoring is the energy I get from thinking about the possibility of what the future looks like. And I do think the responsibility that all leaders have, and it really is, I think, almost a sinful thing, and I do put a lot of pressure on people around this, but our responsibility as a leader is about creating, is the legacy, is the garden that you leave behind. Yeah. It's the most important thing.
What a brilliant answer. Brilliant, brilliant answer. We'll dig into many of the things that you've talked about, but I think it'd be really great to go a beat back to your beginning, because I think much has been justifiably known and awarded in more recent terms about, you know, the work that you've done at Google. But I think just for listeners that might not be familiar with your story, so if I've got this right, you kind of brought up in a village near Watford, is that right?
Yeah, well, I was in Watford and then Bricket Wood, which is not far from that, between Watford and St Albans.
So you have two sisters, and I think I read or listened to or heard your dad saying, quite unusually maybe for parents of that generation and also your background, saying that having three daughters was worth having 10 sons. And I love that. And I wonder where that sort of came from. You sort of go on to talk about your sisters and you all being quite tenacious and having this kind of real sort of spirit, but growing up with parents that were that supportive, who also themselves were interested in the creativity, do you sort of think that was your, does that contribute to this incredible sort of curiosity and sort of thirst for striving to do more? Is that where it comes from?
Definitely. And I, you know, we always root back to our kind of, you know, sometimes we don't always think about it, but when you do and you ponder back on, you know, your early years and those foundations, it often leads to where we get to. So, yeah, I'm the youngest of three girls. My mum and dad, so I'm of Gujarati heritage. I was born here, as were my sisters, but my parents were from India and came to the UK in the 1960s. My mum and dad were actually both creatives when they came here. They'd studied fine art in India, which again was a little bit against the norm for a lot of kind of Indian background, which were often kind of funneled into more professional services or, you know, entrepreneurial things, which my parents did go on to do afterwards. But actually, initially, when my mum and dad came here, my dad, my sister was already here at the moment, so my mum was kind of at home with her, supporting my dad, actually doing some of the work. But my dad worked in an ad agency, you know, just trying to find a job and make a way. And he was a creative and worked on some amazing things, from everything kind of like the Brasso labels to the QE2 brochure. And he was just, you know, bottom rung in a creative agency. And he talks about that time as, you know, I think definitely my work ethic came from that, but also that kind of creativity of following a passion and an interest. And he talks about really tough times, you know, when he describes it, I think, gosh, you know, they were just so accepting of that was the reality of the environment they're in. And it didn't pay very well, but he learned a lot from it. And it's just his attitude of being very singularly focused. He'd often bring work home. My dad's a real kind of graphics person. My mum was the artist, and they worked as a pair. But I suppose in some respects, due to more to kind of traditional roots, they ended up following a more entrepreneurial route, which was fraught, if I'm honest, through lots of kind of highs and lows, maybe more lows than we'd like to have highs. And so it actually gave me that sense of spirit of adventure and risk taking, if I'm honest, because I saw that there wasn't a stability at home. There was a sense of never giving up and a sense of real freedom. And that was all in a time of a backdrop. We lived in a part of England that had no other non-white, certainly no other brown families in the village that we were in. And I remember my parents had bought a shop and as a business, and we lived above it. And I remember being sort of 5-6 years old and people coming in just to see what someone who was brown looked like. And it was bizarre because when you're so young, you have no sense of, you know, it was the 1980s and racism was rife and it was the time of the National Front. But I remember even at that really young age was, and we were suffering from quite a lot of racist attacks quite regularly, windows broken, etc. But my dad had this real sense of strength and was always like, you never look scared, you know, you're never to be beaten by it. This is a lack of understanding. And then he was a tough, strong man, but also kind of really made sure that we inherited that. But what I always remember is very different to other people. As I got older and met more other people of a similar background, the upbringing was different, actually, although we had shared experiences, because my parents did instill this sense of strength and unity, but a real sense of optimism, which I didn't necessarily see from all the other immigrant families that I knew. My dad had this constant belief that anything was possible. And he did always say, you know, because it was hard if you were a parent of daughters in Indian culture, because they were not valued as much. You know, the sense was actually they'd have an education, get married off and be at home. His mum and dad were always like, no, go be whoever you want to be and follow your dreams. And I think that sense of freedom, and sometimes it was frustrating to have a lack of guidance, but actually it was at the heart, I think now I look back, was really my drive. And we were left very much on our own to get on with it. And it was tough.
Yeah.
I'm not going to suggest it wasn't. It really was. And it's definitely been the making of me, because when there is no safety net and there is no backdrop and you're recognised that there is, you're not at the same starting point as someone else, it gives you a very different sense of motivation. But I was encouraged to be a daydreamer. I always was. And I still follow that now and still believe it.
I love that. And I often, and Liz and I talk about this when we go through, you know, and talk through our challenges and our own backgrounds, that actually all of those things create such resilience. And I think that some of the most successful people, you know, in business and in, you know, industry are people that have really sort of come up and come through things. And I think the people that then go on, like what you're doing, to kind of create a more equitable sort of space for others, you're sort of using that experience to create a more equitable space for the next generation. And that's just so admirable.
Yeah.
And one that's not defined as well, I think. Yeah, that's the other thing, is I think I've been, and I still am, and actually one of the things that I'm very passionate about will be kind of following through in my role as president at WACL, is this idea of responsibility about defining the future. You know, I don't believe I should define the future. I think, to your point, Jordan, it's about creating space and creating that space of freedom. You know, I did never wanted to be defined by whether it was stereotypes or cultural tropes or anything else, or, to be quite honest, the biases and the prejudices of those people around me. And I firmly believe the opportunity of future is not for me to lay a playbook or a route for anyone else. It's just to create a space. And one of the things I'm really passionate about is actually, you know, I know how much my life has been influenced by media. That's advertising, that's media, the character, role models, and how much that's impacted my confidence, my lack of being seen. I couldn't see anyone like me, and how much that did cut off avenues and routes, which is why I've always throughout my career been really passionate about working in a space that really could influence change in society and how we see ourselves. But when you think about opportunity, I think that opportunity has to be defined by the next generation. You know, so I'm really keen to give the pen to the next generation of women and say, well, you define how you want to be seen in an ad. Because I could sit here and say, you know, it's really important we make sure we show loads of working women in media, in content, in films, in life. But actually, rightly or wrongly, you know, maybe I've not done the right job here, but my 14-year-old daughter will sometimes say to me, I don't want to just work, Mum. You know, I'm going to work and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And I'm like, oh, okay, great.
That leads us nicely on to your point, because you are founding member of Media for All. So I think it would be really good to sort of understand a little bit more about the work that you do there and why that's so important to you.
Yeah. And so Media for All is a group that was set up by a wonderful man called Naren Patel. And I still distinctly remember this. I think it was nearly 5 years ago, where it was probably about 10 of us. And we were all non-white leaders in the media industry. And he gathered us for a dinner and said, we need to do something about this. You know, we had all, frustratingly been invited on panels to talk about it, but we weren't seeing any change or any progress. There was no community. There was no unity amongst this group. And through his ingenuity, he gathered a group of 10 of us to say, right, let's change this. Let's set up a group. Let's create a community. Let's see how we can really not just support those that need to have visibility, that need to have advice and opportunity and access, but also how we could lobby more smartly. And that, what started out as a group of 10 round dinner, is now a community that's 500 plus strong. It's incredibly well organised. Wow. It offers, you know, job opportunities, constantly being surfaced and offered to those people. It's a very nurturing community. And I think that's testament to everyone who volunteers to do that, and Naren, who set it up and started it and has driven it. And I think I look at that, something that's so new and nascent, alongside WACL that's celebrating 100 years, which is also on a mission of looking at equality. And if I'm honest, you know, I've been a member for about 8 years, and I never wanted to join it. When I'd been to loads of dinners, and WACL for is basically a gathering of the most senior women in advertising and communications and media. And I'd been to dinners and was always impressed by these amazing women in this room. But there was nobody who looked like me there. And I didn't feel like I belong or that I could have an impact. And I didn't want to be in a cliquey environment that was performative in some respects to looking at gender equality, but gender equality for a certain type of woman. Now that's a very harsh review of WAC. And I always remember it was Karen Blackett, who's the current chairman of WPP in the UK, who'd said to me, it was only ever me and Karen at these who were non-white. We always used to joke about it. It was quite easy to find each other. But she said, you've got to join it, because if you don't join it, you can't change it. And I reluctantly did. And actually, the power of that sense of education and information and being part of it and making yourself feel sometimes uncomfortable to be it, I don't think I ever could have imagined I'd be the president. And the president in a year of taking the club from the 100th into the 101st year, it's a real honour and a privilege. But I've met so many women who actually understand their own biases as well and recognise space for all women and really understand the job to be done when we look at modern Britain and modern leadership and the fact that so many more female leaders want to see that progress in our society, in our industry.
That's amazing. And I think that's you know, we share that sort of desire to put ourselves sometimes in positions that are uncomfortable, have conversations in big rooms with people that are not going to like what you're going to hear. That's the whole purpose of good culture, is to help businesses show up more meaningfully. And sometimes you've got to tell them ugly truths, and you don't work with the ones that don't want to change. So I just want to go back a bit, because you talked about sort of labels and labeling and how, and you've got teenage kids, we've all got teenage kids, and I'm sort of interested by something that you said about, you know, they're not going to use these labels. They don't even want them. They don't even want to have words like diverse or minority or other, or, you know, and you, I think you did a speech at a head teacher conference that you sort of said, I'd never normally have done that, but you wanted to talk about this need to future-proof our kids and kind of teach them life skills. And I, you know, sometimes when I talk to my kids about what they're studying on the curriculum, it just feels archaic. Mm-hmm. And it makes me so kind of, you know, upset, worried, all of the above. And I feel like I'm teaching my son's 17, and he's like, you need to teach me about money, about budgeting, about all of these kind of things. When you were talking to these head teachers and you were talking about sort of future proofing and life skills, what are some of those really sort of critical life skills that you think we need to talk to our teenagers about now?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm hugely passionate about the revolution that needs to happen in education. And I think that will come from parents and corporates as well as within the system. And I fear sometimes not fast enough, which is why, you know, some of the work I do at Google around digital skills is so critical as well, because it's filling the gaps. I think some of those skills are around those life skills. It's things like critical thinking. You know, jobs of the future, which are impossible to predict, are still, you know, education is still taught in a way that it was 50, 60 years ago, where there were very simple, delineated roles and responsibilities around certain skills and certain behaviours. The reality is technology has upended that to a greater degree. Life has, and society has, and actually the way we want to live it. But some of those core things, you know, critical thinking, emotional intelligence, the ability to be curious, expression, communication, you know, no machines or technology or systems will replace those strong humanity skills. And I think that ability to be able to not just in from a work point of view, but from a life point of view, which certainly the last few years really taught us, our ability to adapt and change through COVID and coming out of it and everything we face now, I think really pushes hard at that point of, are children equipped with the skills that mean that they can live a life, let alone find a job? You know, the fact that the skills, you know, stuff like AI developments will completely change the way we think about computer skills and what we do. The fact that I couldn't agree more with you about financial skills, you know, and actually a lot of the stuff we do training with entrepreneurs and individuals is all about financial skills and training, because, you know, when Rishi Sunak talks about going, let's all do math till we're 18, I was like, no. I mean, also my kids were totally distraught at that thought, but You know, I would love it. And I'm sure a brilliant bank, someone probably like the Lloyds Banking Group or someone like that who's significant in this country, should take that and say, what we really need to do when kids and force everyone to the age of 18 is teach them about personal money. Because people don't know how to create a mortgage. They budgeting. Don't understand how to catch their tax or budgeting. Those are life skills. And they will, of course, apply more future. Yeah. So I think the practicality of our skills are important. But I do think things like critical thinking, problem solving, curiosity, communication, they need much more development at a younger age and the thirst and joy of learning. The one thing that we can be sure of is continuous learning is going to be a core part of our lives. Very different to my parents' generation and generations before, where learning was something you did, you completed and you moved on. Now we're in a state of continuously learning. And so if you don't build a love for learning and growth, but the only thing we can be sure of as all humans is we continue to grow mentally, is that actually, how do you make children love learning? Because the way the systems we have today means that they'll be resistant to it. And a little bit like the Skills to Go campaign, which is all to do with our digital skills training, came about from an insight that the reality is we have a workforce who, you know, the lion's share of our workforce in the UK are pretty digitally able, but they now need the next set of skills. But there is a resistance to learning. And the reality is there's a time factor, you know, who's got time when you're trying to juggle life? And so Skills to Go was trying to demonstrate to people that actually learning can be in bite-sized moments and enjoy constantly trying to improve, whether it was simple things like, you know, tips on writing your CV or actually learning how to build a marketing campaign or start a business, whatever it might be. And I am really passionate about that idea of how do we make learning to be more accessible, more enjoyable, and more part of our everyday life. And there's so many resources nowadays to do that, because I think that's a part of our society needs to keep moving forward.
I'm so close to that notion of particularly alternative learning, because my son, he's autistic and has significant learning disabilities, really. So the way in which technology helps him access, you know, information, like even when he's searching on Google, he uses the voice kind of microphone because he can't write. And I just think how brilliant that we are in a world where actually we're using technology to remove barriers. And I'm really excited as we continue with AI and technology and innovation that actually people that perhaps typically would have been excluded and not have the access are being brought in. And I think that sort of is underpinned by the work that you're also doing from a sort of diversity and equality and sort of gender equality perspective as well. One of the things I wanted to ask you is, obviously we're talking about gatekeepers and culture, but would love to know if there was someone who sort of championed you and sort of mentored you and gave you that foot in the door in the same way that you pay it forward for so many other people.
Oh, I think everyone has, you know, we've all got our guardian angels, whether we label them, know them to be that way. I mean, I can think throughout my career, I've had great men and women who've really opened doors for them. I mean, someone in more recent years who's just a phenomenal woman is Dame Cilla Snowball, who, in her previous career was at a big advertising agency, is now a non-exec at some incredible businesses like the Wellcome Trust. But Cilla has been someone who is just incredibly selfless in how she has supported and helped and guided me. And actually, I mean, I met her the other day and she said, I'm soon to be 50. And she said, you're like a 20-year-old in a 50-year-old body. Although that day I believe that.
Yes.
A 5-year-old body. But I think that sense of finding people, my previous boss, Ronan Harris, who's great at Snapchat, he was another one. It's people who, for me, the ones that have had the greatest impact on me, and not the ones who've just created room at a table or in a room. It's the ones who've encouraged my curiosity and have been limitless, have demonstrated the limitless to my potential or my thinking. You know, not ones who, and there've been far too many, unfortunately, we all know the ones who kind of go, oh, you know, I don't think you could quite do that. You know, from when I was a kid at school to all the way through life, managers and colleagues and whatever who might just go, oh, I don't know if you could do that. And I've, you know, you rail against it. And you see the ones who can flourish, who say, well, why not? Go do it. You know, be piratical and do it. Or why not follow that? And they will nudge you and shape you, and that's great. And for me, yeah, there are so many. Karen Blackett's another one who's been an incredible friend and ally and supporter of being able to kind of read it, and sometimes gives you the tough love. So yeah, I think it is really important to have, you know, I always say it to everyone, you know, you don't necessarily need to seek mentors. You need to seek people who fill your soul, but will give you the hard talking to as well. You know, who will give you the honesty and truth.
Listening to sort of other interviews where you've talked about this idea of kind of imposter syndrome, which I think, I don't know anybody that hasn't got that really, but you did talk a bit about that and you're very honest about that. And I'm just sort of interested to learn in this, you know, because following your career, you know, it's hard to believe that you could have felt like that. And yeah, I do. I know you
do. We all do.
What was the sort of moment where you realised that, you know, success wasn't about luck, it was about bloody hard work? And when did it switch for you where you actually truly believed that you were not an imposter and you deserved a seat at the table and you were, you know, in those big rooms for a reason? Can you remember something which made you change your mind on that?
I don't know if I have, if I'm honest. They're all a work in progress. I've actually got a great friend and coach who constantly makes me stop and go, Nish, look what you've just told me. You know, what's that thing? And actually, I think it's a real hindrance. And actually, I read a great piece recently about imposter syndrome as a kind of a label that so many of us have adopted, but actually, is it one that's been created? You know, is it a bit of a let off that actually none of us should feel that way, because it's a responsibility of others to, you know, all the things we just talked about creating space and room. Actually, if you were supported in that way, if I had been supported in that way and hadn't felt like the only one in a room, and I've had horrific experiences through my career of incredible bias and prejudice and genuinely seeing it played out, you know, and actually I think in some respects it was easier when it was overt. Whereas now it's very, you know, it's much more kind of hidden and you don't see it and it's subtle in where it is. But the reality is that I do believe, I think where I got to, where I've got better at it, I had some good little trips. There was one that was called, I call it my yay me folder. And so when something good happens, someone sends you an email and they say, you know, well done, Nish, you did this. And I tag it as yay me. It's really like bizarre. When I
love that.
And when you have that moment of doubt, I go back to my yay folder and you look at this trail of things that people have, it's feedback and it's that, but it also reminds you to go, I have done this. I think age has also played a big part of it. You start to get to an age where you think, kind of fuck it a little bit, you know, I'm here now. And I always remember Karen saying to me once, she said, never ask why you got to the room or how you got to the room. Just think about what you're doing once you're in the room. Because she said, you cannot
control.
You can't control the reasons why I got the room. And I'll be honest, I still face it now. People go, oh, she's there because she's, you know, she's the brown lady. She got in the room. And you feel it. And it's really, like, I'm very open and honest that my mental health has really suffered. You know, I'm an incredible person in the sense of hiding it. And I shouldn't always, but I do. I carry that shield. And that's partly just part of my personality. But I'm also honest to go, I don't have it all together. We're all vulnerable. I think that was a great piece of advice from her and was a bit of a turning point for me to start questioning, was it because, you know, I was just a bit lucky that they were pushing me in there? She said, never do that, because it's what you do in the room, what you prove who you are is what matters. And I always remember my old boss Ronan saying to me in quite cross terms one day, saying, when are you going to stop this nonsense and realise your value? Stop compromising with yourself. The only person you're compromising with is you, nobody else. I think sometimes those hard messages, you just have to go, yeah, do you know what? I'm right. I've got to do it.
Yeah. When you hear those from people whose opinion is valuable to you as well. I just wanted to pick up on one thing that you talked about, which is bias, which I think is maybe not as understood as we think it is. And you sort of had spoken about the need for more inclusive media planning. So I think you said that sort of in the advertising industry, there is quite a lot of focus on, you know, inclusive representation and creativity and in adverts, but that actually, and you'd actually singled out Domino's and Diageo, sorry, not Diego. I think he's like a character from a children's TV program, but actually that those guys had made positive choices in terms of creative representation. But can you talk a little bit more about what you mean by, you know, potential biases in sort of keyword and topic exclusions? And what do you mean by needing to apply that same thinking to the sort of media buying process and media planning process? Because I think that will maybe limit a couple of the listeners, because it's quite sort of industry specific. But
really,
I think just unconscious bias is a term that, you know, I only learned a couple of years ago, and I'm now sort of talking to my 17-year-old about it. And I was surprised that it had taken me to the ripe old age of 47 to really kind of understand what that means. And I don't think that a lot of us know we've got it.
No. And I think it's, you know, and actually there was a great piece recently about, you know, does unconscious, you know, can you be trained out of it? My personal view is, and this was at the heart of the campaign that we ran with Marcus Rashford, which was all around this idea of the more we learn, the closer we get. A lot of our impressions of life or unconscious biases come from a lack of understanding or education. And I don't mean education in the grand sense. I mean just knowledge of what we know. And so, for example, that campaign with him came about as I was observing how many people turn to search, and we ask really intimate questions to search, like stuff you don't really want to ask your mate. So you kind of go, what does this mean? Because you think you should know it. And it was at the time of the summer of football, and you know, there was a lot of debate and controversy about people taking the knee, and it felt like the discussion in media was really polarized, and it was either you were for or you were against. But actually what I could see in the search queries was that people didn't even know. They didn't actually know what it meant to take the knee. And so you were amazed at doing this. And so we ran this campaign of, like, the more you learn, the closer you get. And my view of this idea of bias and how it plays out in kind of media buying, which comes back to that piece around, we can really shift society. You know, working in industry, whether it's advertising, communications, content creation, the influencers and talents and stars who use their platforms, we are all at that front level piece of changing how people see the world and think about the world. And there's been lots of emphasis on the cast of characters and a representation of people who tell those stories. There's been lots of thoughts around the creativity and more authentic portrayal of people's lives rather than sort of tokenistic gestures. But actually, the failing comes that that's great, but if you don't go to where people are, then the stories are never going to be heard at a scale, or you're talking in an echo chamber. So it's around,
yeah,
actually what I could see and observe is we were making these wonderful campaigns and stories and content, but actually, was it really reaching the people I wanted to make sure reached it? So when I was working with Marcus and I'm thinking about the folk in Withenshaw or in Oldham or somewhere else, like, but I'm not sure they're seeing this work, because media buying was being done around an approach and a process that was kind of very much feeding to a mass market nature of assuming that minority groups or other groups were going to do it. It's not always minority groups. It's actually people are trying to change their mind of as well. It might be mass market. And actually one of the talks I gave recently was around a lot of the social media platforms. So YouTube and TikTok particularly have this huge number of diverse creators. So not surprisingly, you know, diverse communities or minority communities haven't been able to find themselves represented, their stories, authentic portrayal, or whatever it means that matters to them in mainstream media. And yes, we're seeing a shift in mainstream media, whether it's thanks to Edward and what he's done at Vogue and looking at, you know, magazines or efforts at Channel 4. You know, you can see a shift, but there's a reality that there is commercials and other economics involved in here that mean there's a big swathe of people who've gone and found their tribe and found their niche in other platforms. And what's interesting about that is then you say, well, this is really interesting because people want it and need it. And wouldn't it be better to place the stories there or the adverts or the content where it really matters? And so I'm really passionate about seeing, and it is starting to happen, a real revolution around media buying, because for all the good we do here, if it doesn't get to the people that need to see it in the right channels, then we're going to fail. And I think that's where things like Netflix and Amazon Prime and Disney, and looking at some of the shift in the programming there and how they market it, you're starting to see an awareness of that, because there's a commercial sense to it, but there's a real societal opportunity, because the danger is otherwise you leave vacuums of and polarization in society that then will be filled by other things.
Yeah. And I think also part of that is not just on the front end. So not just the people that we're seeing on the screens and the storytellers, but it's actually the people behind the scenes. And I think quite often in a lot of these organizations, particularly in the media buying space, there aren't as many people from sort of different communities who could probably be kind of going, well, hang on a minute, the Daily Mail isn't going to necessarily land this for the activation and actually have that point of view. So again, it always goes back to authentically creating sort of inclusive spaces, not just at the front end and what we're seeing in front of the lens, but it has to be behind the lens as well. And not to plug my friend's company, but she started a production company called They Gather, which is exactly that, pulling together creative, diverse teams that serve behind the lens, not just, you know, the sort of the thing on the other side. Otherwise, it still is performative for me. It still feels like it's, you know, just so surface.
I make it a requirement that I look at all of the production teams that work on our work, you know, because to your point, Jordan, I want to make sure that you're giving opportunity. You know, you can only really get to authentic portrayal if you have more voices around the table. And it's, you've got to have a variety of voices because you've got to have correction sometimes as well, because you can go too far and too niche.
Yeah.
Around actually, how do you get the right balance? And that's why I will also favour a good mixture in the team. I never want it to kind of, you know, in some respects, I think there's been a bit of a pendulum swing. That's when you get to quite performance tokenistic behaviour, whereas actually ones who are nailing it and doing really well have been really smart going, your representation. But you still see, you know, fashion brands have failed recently, and you sometimes sit there and go, do you have anyone in your business who was saying, not really sure this is going to work, you know? And I think that's, you know, from engineering and when we look at our products to, I heard this great story about someone who was working on a business, which was like one of these kind of period trackers. And it was an all-male team. I hadn't thought about, you know, I'm like getting some women in here that have had a period maybe in my... You can't make it up. And so I think there's a bit of a common sense. To your point, Jordan, it's like gives reality to why you need diversity in teams and that authentic portrayal. But just putting people in teams is not enough. You've got to give them space and confidence to be able to talk about, you know, it's like the imposter syndrome mustn't exist. People need to feel empowered and not scared. You know, I spent most of my career in life being trying to suppress my identity and didn't want people to know I was Indian, or then didn't want to know I was from a working class background, and never had the access to culture that I have now. And people often say, you're always like this, Nish. And I was like, well, I was brought up on incredible, rich, quite a lot of Indian culture. You know, and so I loved lots of kind of Indian music and that. But also my mum and dad, they were quite hip and trendy. So they loved a bit of Donna Summer, like, you know, clothes, music. So I did have...
That sounds so cool, by the way.
They do sound very cool.
So they did. I had this window into it. But I always say to people, it's not like you're the coolest influencer or you've got the kind of loveliest Instagram. It's your curiosity is what makes you culturally, you're interested and relevant and able to be open to stories. Because it's those, it's not the ones who are the hippest and trendiest. It's the ones who have the most curious minds that I think can really observe culture, spot opportunities of change and hope, and really lean into it.
I agree. And just to touch on your point that you talked about around class, Liz and I were talking about sort of code switching, because I guess, and not to be like, oh, we're coming out as working class now, guys. I mean, you probably can tell by my very Croydon accent. But, you know, I think for the vast majority of my career, I think I really resonate with that piece around making yourself sort of small. Because I remember going to a lot of these sort of fashion-y events. And really, I think the first time I ever went to a Vogue event where it felt diverse was under the leadership of Edward. I was like, oh, my God, there are so many black people in London. Like, Where have you guys been? And so, you know, I definitely kind of then had to sort of present myself in a certain way, particularly then being a teenage mum from Croydon in a council house. I was like, tick, 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 all the cliches. And, you know, you just sort of think you're having to prove yourself more, and you have a similar, not quite the same.
I'm from a working class background as well. I mean, I totally relate. I think also when you come to London for the first time, well, I'm not from London, and you're trying to find your people, it's lonely, it's disorienting. I, you know, chose a job where I wasn't, I was one of the only females as well. And you're just trying to find your tribes and find your people. But I think now, and I do agree with you, Nishma, that age is, I've only felt like me in the last 5 years. Like that is newsflash. I'm talking to my 17-year-old about teenagers and it being miserable. And I'm not sugarcoating it. I'm going, it's pretty shit. Until you find your people. And that might be at university or it might not, but just try and find the joy in every day to get through this. But I'm here to tell you that when you have a bit more agency and life experience, it gets a lot more pleasant. I mean, not to say there's different struggles, and bringing up teenagers, you know, every day provides an interesting struggle. But I do think you get to a place of peace and you get to a place of contentment. I love the word being content, and people misunderstand it as kind of settling. And I'm one of the most ambitious, driven, curious people I know, but I'm also, I love being content. I love like just being quiet and calm and grateful and all of those things. And I do think that comes with age. But I also went, now when I go meet people at all these fancy parties that we're talking about, they're all like us. I don't know anyone that was classically trained in anything. They're all bloody outsiders. Outsiders make the best people. We're all, you know, is that kind of richness of story. And so I just kind of, I'm getting more and more confident that we deserve to be at the tables that we're at. And I think that's just progress for women. It's progress in life in general. So I think that, but people like you are true, you know, examples of using your platform to help others thrive. And you know, you sound like you're having a lovely time while you're doing it. And just long may we meet and talk to and question and learn from people that are in the position you're in, because it's been honestly a total pleasure and a delight to talk to you. Just want to finish. We have to ask you about your DJing because it's so not what we were expecting on the old bio, Nishma. We were like, yeah, we've seen this and the Marcus Rashford stuff and the equality and the, but like we're looking at Nishma now, for people that can't see this. I can see Lauryn Hill. I can see Dr. Dre.
Yeah.
Talk to us. Is this like a lockdown passion that came from nowhere? Does this come from like Donna Summer listening?
Yeah. Do you know, I do think it was from such a young age. I was listening to, you know, I love music, so I can't sing. Terrible singers. Did my children tell me all the time. I love to dance. You know, that's my kind of outlet and freedom. But I've always loved music. You know, it's been such a big part of my life. It's where I love. I think it's the greatest expression of culture, actually, when you look at the breadth of music. So I've always loved music. And I think I've thought, well, you know, collect lots of music and have explored and gigs and that, but always wanted to be a DJ. And it was one of these things that I've got lots of friends that are DJs. And someone said to me, why don't you give me, you know, you've got a real great ear for the rhythm. You know, I could stand in a club and I'll figure out what they're going to play next. I've not found many skills in my life. I've discovered very late in my life I had this skill of being able to hear music. Is that right? And I thought, you know what? I reckon there's a market for a 50-year-old DJ. So I, yes, I got some decks for a present a few years ago and started learning and love it. Not quite ready to do gigs yet.
How often do you do it then? Are you going out and doing parties? Are you doing it just for friends? Or do we need to book you for our Christmas
party? I think this is going to be the next year. Do you know what, though? I was trying to explain to someone, and it did, you know, obviously through the pandemic, it was a real thing, is when we're all trying to find that, you know, and I've walked around the park only so many times you can do it. But for me, you know, some people will go off and play the piano or they want to do that. For me, it would be literally sitting down at the decks and mixing music and discovering different ways. And just that was the relaxation. And I think it's been a tough time for everyone in every respect, whether it's work or home or otherwise. And it's been, for me, it's the outlet. My kids love music. I used to, when they were tiny, I used to have Saturday mornings was music education time. And I'm very proud that they have a breadth of love of music. And they initially were like really horrifically embarrassed that their mum's been a DJ. And now they're really proud of me. Now they're like, yeah, good mom.
I love that.
Oh, my goodness.
I love that.
They're DJ coming to a party near you. Coming to a party near you, yeah.
We're going to make that happen. So I think just to finish off, we are interested in how people listening to this, just in their day-to-day life, and you talked about it's not always the biggest of actions, how can we all show up more meaningfully in culture? Mm-hmm. you know, what can some, you know, what are two or three things that people can do at home that will just make them change their little corner of the planet for good?
So I would say my greatest encouragement is follow your curiosity. Sometimes it's just asking someone just that extra question and really listening to them. Something about their background, their childhood. When you see something you don't quite know, is just go and find out that bit of information and retell it. You know, that's the thing, isn't it? That it's the bit, the greatest gift we have is what we learn about someone else and we can share on, because that's how we improve.
Well, the world is so much better for people like you, Nishma. We want to offline this. We're doing the pub and a chat and the picantes as well. And I really want to dig into more and also learn how we can kind of support and be involved in all the wonderful things that you do. So thank you so much for showing up with Good Culture.
Thank you so much.
I mean, that was just such a great chat. We could have just continued for hours, to be honest.
Oh my God, she's the best.
She's the best. But one of the things I was really thinking was just, how does she find the time? She does so much.
Well, we think we've got energy.
I mean,
I want to know what she has for breakfast. I mean,
she's got to be on the shrooms.
She has just got, do you know what I think it is? And Al is like this, and he's made me more like this, is this curiosity, this kind of permission to daydream that is not just for when you're a kid.
Yeah.
This idea that, you know, the more we learn, the closer we get to the answer of things. That's, I think, what keeps her going, because she's achieved so much. And yet there's this whole sort of like just getting started vibe. It's,
she was giving just getting started.
She was giving.
And radiating. Like, I was like, yeah. she's about to go on to the next major thing.
I think she's honestly phenomenal. And I'm so pleased that we get to ask the questions that we get and share those, just share a bit of that vibe and energy. I think some of the other things that I loved, this revolution in education that needs to happen.
Oh my God.
The fact that, you know, and I'm sure lots of people listening will either have kids or godchildren or, you know,
people in their
people
life
that they want to better. And just through my own kids, observing my own kids sort of going to school, I think that, and I've now got, you know, 2 10-year-olds and 2 13-year-olds and 17-year-olds. I've got this whole spectrum going on, and I can just see, you know, the dwindling of the love of reading happening.
Oh, yeah,
and all
totally
of this kind of stuff. But also they are just learning about the same shit that
we
learned
about. Well, it's scary, isn't it? When you really think about the fact that look how much the world has changed.
Yeah.
And yet we're learning in a way that we were learning 60 years ago.
It's mad.
That's terrifying.
And I'm actively having Bram coming to me going, hi, I'm probably going to go off to uni next year. Does anyone want to teach me about a budget or how to cook? Or
yeah.
And I think this idea of the three sort of life skills or some life skills that we need to lobby educators to put on mainstream curriculums is emotional intelligence, is critical thinking, you know, and this idea that we just got to equip these kids better for being spat out into the world and it not just being so, and even I've got personal frustration with the current school my kids are at about dress and this idea that, you know, it's part of your
identity.
Oh my God. So when you get, do you remember when you went to sixth form and you could like lob off your blazer and you could put on, like for me, it was like a top with like James sit down on the back because those were the days. But it was
on the
just
bum.
Like, it was proper, like, you know, I don't know, rite of passage to go, I am, have earned the right to just express myself and fashion an identity, which I know are really important to Nishma and ours, are being kind of thwarted in certain schools because it's this idea that if you don't wear a suit, it won't prepare you for the workspace. Who the fuck do you know that wears a suit to work anymore?
Not
even
apart
bankers.
From my accountant.
Well, maybe, but also if you want a...
Who is 60?
You know, I think there's plenty of jobs that we would consider to be corporate where, you know, they're not wearing like a sort of scratchy suit.
No.
I don't know. I think there's, I want to really get on board with this sort of skills to go campaign and all the work she's doing around teaching kids about life skills. I think that is amazing. And the other thing I'm going to start as of today is I'm going to create a Yay Me folder.
A Yay Me folder is essential.
And for those that didn't catch it, so she's talking about it's sort of based on imposter syndrome, which I think we all have, this idea that every positive email or note or text or WhatsApp or other platforms are available, a message that you get that makes you feel good, that you just put it in a folder. And for the times that you're not feeling good, and you sent me a lovely voice note last night, and it was all just, and that's what you're brilliant at doing. I want to remember those moments.
Yeah.
When you're feeling shit or just in a bit of a fog, where you go, fucking hell, this is what I do, and this is how much I affect change, and this is what I show up to do in this Yay Me folder. Imagine looking at that at the end of every month, going, there were some Yay Me times.
Yeah, because there's times where you really feel like it's no me. There's just a lot of no's and a lot of truth days, which we can go on to another time.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.